Any day now, the U.S. Supreme Court will announce its decision on same-sex marriage. This hour, how advocates for same-sex marriage got to this point. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The justices of the High Court are deciding whether gays and lesbians have a constitutional right to marry or whether states' bans against same-sex marriage can stay in place. Today we'll find out how advocates for same-sex marriage have been working for decades to have marriages treated equally under the law in all 50 states. We'll ask what's been going on behind the scenes and what the long-awaited U.S. Supreme Court decision means for the future. Join our conversation. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Much anticipation as the days in June tick away. This month, the U.S. Supreme Court is set to make a decision on same-sex marriage. The justices of the High Court are deciding whether gays and lesbians have a constitutional right to marry and whether state bans against same-sex marriage can stay in place. Six cases from Ohio, Michigan, Tennessee, Kentucky, all rolled into one for this court's consideration. A total of 32 plaintiffs say they should have a right to marry or have their marriages recognized in their home states. Most experts predicting the court will rule in their favor, but we will not know until that decision is announced. This hour, we want to hear how advocates for same-sex marriage have been working for decades to have all marriages treated equally under the law in 50 states. We'll learn about what's been going on behind the scenes to create this sea change in public opinion and what the long-awaited U.S. Supreme Court decision means for the future. We would like to have you join our conversation. What do you think has been the biggest reason opinions in this country have changed so rapidly regarding same-sex marriage? Join us via our social media, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send us an email at this address, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Or join us via our toll-free listener line, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Joining us for the entire hour, Camilla Taylor is with us, attorney and strategist for Lambda Legal. Camilla Taylor was the lead attorney and strategist in the Varnum case, which led to same-sex marriage being declared legal in Iowa back in 2009. Camilla Taylor, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Solomon is with us as well, national campaign director for Freedom to Marry. That's an advocacy group, and also author of Winning Marriage. Mark Solomon, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, let's start with you. We hear a lot about the latest news as it unfolds day by day, in this case, year by year. Let's go back and have you put this in some historical context. When did the organizing for marriage equality really start? What was the spark?
You know, you can pinpoint it on a few different moments, but I'd say the real spark for this organizing started about 20 years ago in Hawaii when we had our first victory in state courts, and the Hawaii judges ruled that that you had to look very carefully. You had to treat with a higher level of scrutiny, denying gay couples the right to marry. Once they ruled that way, it began this real effort across the country. Gay and lesbian people were inspired that they actually could get married, and that began the movement that we're hopefully in the final chapter of today.
Mm-hmm. Give us a quick survey as what you see since that mark, say, 20 years ago, the milestones you see along that path, the catalyst moments in the movement.
So yeah, there were plenty of ups and plenty of downs, but we had that victory in Hawaii. Immediately afterwards, Congress passed the so-called Defense of Marriage Act that the federal government wouldn't need to respect any marriages that took place on the state level. We also saw a bunch of constitutional amendments enacted at the state level. But then on the positive side, first in Vermont with civil unions, and then in Massachusetts, when I first really got involved in 2003 and then 2004, we had our first court victory and the first round of marriages on May 17th, 2004. And, you know, after that, we didn't have another victory until California in 2008, which was then taken away at the ballot in November of 2008. So it has been plenty of ups and downs. And when people say to me, and I'm sure to Camilla, my friend Camilla as well, you know, everything has been moving along so quickly. On the one hand, of course, it's true. Over the past couple of years, things have been moving quickly. But this has been a movement many, many years in the making.
Camilla Taylor, give us your take on this. Your position at Lambda Legal started when? When did this pick up in a serious way, and you see this as part of a national campaign?
Well, I actually agree with Mark. And, of course, Mark and I have been working together many years to try and see this day when the Supreme Court would decide whether same-sex couples have the freedom to marry nationwide. So it's very exciting that we are finally before the Supreme Court, and we're hoping for a good decision. We're optimistic about the result, and we'll see before the end of June. Looking at what the pivot points are in our history, I agree that our lawsuit in Hawaii in the 1990s was really the catalyst for the most recent wave of marriage lawsuits in this country, and the successful wave that has really precipitated things to this point. But then the Massachusetts Goodrich decision that Mark mentioned is also a huge one, and the California marriage cases that, you know, later were unfortunately stopped from being effective to the extent that they weren't able to issue any more marriage licenses after Proposition 8 passed. And then actually Connecticut and Iowa issued decisions. Iowa was one of the decisions that I think really prompted people to change their minds about lesbian and gay people and about the freedom to marry and about how this country should value all families. Mm-hmm. And that's because Iowa's decision at that time, given what had happened in California with Proposition 8, was actually the third state in the country to allow same-sex couples to marry. And when that happened, Iowa became a destination for couples all around the country that wanted to marry and that were prevented from marrying in their home states, and made a huge difference for the nation.
Mm-hmm. Is it also because of Iowa not being a New York, not being a Massachusetts, not being a California or Hawaii culturally that boosted the campaign?
I think that was a very big factor. It showed that lesbian and gay people live all around the country, and that the value of love and commitment that was affirmed by the Iowa Supreme Court in requiring same-sex couples to be able to marry in Iowa, that's a heartland value that we can all appreciate. And that was very important, I think, in precipitating change. Mm-hmm. And I also like to think of it as precipitating all of these micro acts of bravery by ordinary people around the country who may not have had the ability to be out about who they were and who they continue to be 20 years ago. But as we've allowed people to step forward and get married, and as we've made changes in the law that protect and shield families, it's become, I think, a lot easier for people to acknowledge not only who they are, but their loving relationships to each other. And that has helped people to change their minds, because it's very difficult today for people to say that they don't know a lesbian or gay person. And part of what has created a climate in which it's possible to be out and it's possible to feel affirmed by your community is having government treat every family equally.
Mm-hmm. Mark Solomon, talk about that personal connection that was necessary for this movement to succeed. The fact that you may have lived across the street or up the street from a couple you had not really thought about in a same-sex relationship or in your town?
Well, yeah, that has been at the heart of our at the heart of this this effort. Our regular people sharing their stories, and what we've seen is that marriage is a big enough deal, is important enough to same-sex couples that they've been willing to step out of their comfort zones and talk about why marriage is important to them, and not only in the places where it's relatively safe. The vision of being able to marry was a big enough deal that people all over the country, in rural communities and suburban communities, same-sex couples, you know, were willing to talk about why it was so important. And that precipitated huge amounts of change, because I think, you know, early on in you know, around 2000, and you know, you had plenty of people who would be like, well, the gay community lives there. They live in New York City. They live in San Francisco. It's not, you know, they aren't in Davenport and in Sioux City, et cetera, et cetera. They aren't in my neighborhood. I think what the marriage movement has done is it's shown that there's so many couples who are just regular folks living in people's neighborhoods. You know, the kid of my college roommate's daughter who just married her spouse, or the nice couple that lives down the street that goes to the dog park with me in the morning. I think that's really shifted how Americans see gay and lesbian people, and they have an understanding of who we are as members of their community. And when you get to know people on the local level, nothing is really more important than that.
Mm-hmm. And Camilla, as this movement snowballed, the people who were quiet, you called them micro acts of bravery. They were brought out because they moved from what I'm guessing is a place of resignation, as living in a same-sex relationship without any hope of marriage, to wait, there could be another way.
I think that's right. I mean, we have generations of people, older generations, who grew up thinking that they would never see this day in their lifetimes. And they found ways to try and avoid discrimination in their communities, and that usually involved being very quiet and not rocking the boat sometimes. And I think when government has begun to treat people fairly by allowing everyone the freedom to marry and recognizing marriages of same-sex couples entered into in other states, then that has allowed people to feel affirmed in who they are and to be more active in speaking out. And one of the things we have to think about is that if we are fortunate enough to win the freedom to marry this month before the Supreme Court nationwide, which means that, you know, currently there are 36 states that allow same-sex couples to marry in the District of Columbia, but there are 14 that do not. So those additional states would be swept into the consensus and required to treat people fairly. If that happens, we're going to be in this odd and in some ways very vulnerable situation where a majority of states around the country still don't prevent discrimination based on sexual orientation expressly. They don't prohibit it in their state laws. So people will be able to marry everywhere, and they will be coming out, in essence, by doing so, because marriage is public record. And yet they could come to work the following day and be fired for who they are, for the act of having gotten married to someone they love, because their state laws still lack any explicit protection from discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. So that is obviously a great concern to us, and it highlights, I think, a lot of the work that remains for us in the days ahead. But of course, we need to allow some time to look back and celebrate at how much rapid progress we have seen. And that's due to a lot of folks, some very brave families in Iowa, six couples who stepped forward and joined a lawsuit back in 2005. And a lot of folks like Mark, who were out there trying to change public opinion for years and years. And so many others around the country who stood up and announced who they were to their families or to their coworkers or to their, the fellow parents of their kids at school.
Camilla Taylor is with us, attorney and strategist for Lambda Legal. Mark Solomon, also national campaign director for Freedom to Marry. Join our conversation. What do you think have been the main reasons for opinions in this country changing so rapidly? Did your mind get changed in the last, say, 10 or 15 years? What was it that did that mind-changing? 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Looking for some longer-range context for where we find ourselves in a month when the U.S. Supreme Court will decide about same-sex marriage for 50 states or make some sort of decision. Let's go to Mary Lee Sargent in New Hampshire. Hello. Mary Lee Sargent, calling from a state that early on declared same-sex marriages legal.
Yes, 2009, and I got to attend on New Year's Eve, which actually after midnight, so it was actually January 1st, 2010, the marriages of about 100 couples at our state capitol. I'm calling partly to thank your guests. I don't use the word hero very often because I think it's been overused, but Mr. Solomon and Ms. Taylor and so many others who've worked on this cause are heroes to me, and I really want to thank you for your work, but also for this program, because even though I've been an activist in the, you know, what we call the gay rights movement in the 70s, but has become more inclusive to be the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, QQ movement, I don't know the ins and outs of a lot of the legal cases, and so I'm anxious to hear more about that, because that's one aspect I have not followed, even though I've been very active.
Okay, Mary Lee Sargent from New Hampshire, thanks for your call. Thanks for listening from out east.
You're welcome.
Let's talk about that. Camilla, can you tell us a little bit about, we hear so much about from you about Iowa, understandably so, but set Iowa in the context. How do you choose the cases that you argue, which states you go to, which poster couples you pick up?
Well, first, thanks for the kind words to the caller. And Iowa was one of the earliest states in which we chose to bring a case, in part because Iowa had this long history and tradition of recognizing the civil rights of minorities, often long before its sister states. And so we could rely on that tradition in saying, look, there's nothing that is different in this struggle from the way that Iowa has exercised a leadership role in the past. And Iowa lived up to that in terms of being among the first states to allow same-sex couples to marry. In other states, we chose to litigate in part because there was a similar tradition, but also there may have been very strong case law on which we could rely, interpreting the liberty and equality guarantees of the Constitution. And in some states, we passed marriage through legislation, and that was a fight that Mark was very involved in. And whether you could do that turned on a lot of political considerations, of course. We also had to work very hard to avoid pushback at the same time from state capitals, including in Iowa. When we were able to win victories, we needed to make sure that we were not reversed in those victories by an effort to, say, amend state constitutions. And then there were three states that actually passed referenda, affirmatively embracing the freedom to marry, and one that actually rejected an anti-gay constitution amendment. And so those were exciting developments in 2012. And that helped to pave the way, I think, for the Supreme Court's decision in Windsor in 2013. And the Windsor decision was a case involving whether the federal government may refuse to respect the marriages that same-sex couples enter into validly in some states at that time. There were, I think, 11 or 12 states that permitted same-sex couples to marry at the time that the Supreme Court rendered its decision in Windsor. And the Supreme Court struck down the federal law known as DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, holding that it violated equal protection and due process principles to deny same-sex couples respect for their valid marriages. And the Windsor decision just started an avalanche of state and federal court rulings around the country, more than 60 since Windsor, that have struck down marriage bans around the nation and have brought us from 11 or 12 states allowing same-sex couples to marry, plus the District of Columbia, all the way to 36 at the moment. The Supreme Court is currently considering five consolidated cases from four states in the Sixth Circuit in a group of cases they've named Obergefell versus Hodges. And these are cases from Michigan and Kentucky and Tennessee and Ohio. And in these cases, unfortunately, the Sixth Circuit, which is the intermediate appellate court for those states, ruled that those marriage bans could be upheld as constitutional. And the Supreme Court agreed to hear that case, these consolidated cases, and will decide, in essence, two questions. The first is whether same-sex couples can deny, whether states can deny same-sex couples the freedom to marry. And then the second question that the court is considering is whether states have to recognize the marriages that same-sex couples enter into in other states.
Mm-hmm. So when we await this decision, the different possibilities are how many?
Well, the court, basically three. The court could rule on for us on both of those questions. So it could rule not only that same-sex couples have the freedom to marry in every state in the country, that they're guaranteed the freedom to marry as a matter of state or federal constitutional law, rather, but also that states must respect the marriages entered into in other states. And if the court rules for us on question one, which is whether states must give licenses to same-sex couples, then that automatically means we win on question two. The court also could rule simply that states must respect marriages entered into by same-sex couples in other states, but that the Constitution doesn't guarantee the affirmative right to marry for same-sex couples in every state. And that is a very unworkable ruling. It's very unlikely. It's hard to see how those would really be logically consistent and a possible ruling. And it seemed unlikely when we listened to the oral arguments in Obergefell that the court would do that. And then the final possibility is that we could lose on both questions. And also, I really do not think that that is a likely ruling, because I think we've reached a stage in our country's history where it is very much publicly acknowledged that the right to marry is an acknowledgement of our common humanity. And I think it is at this point pretty much time for the Supreme Court to rule. And I think this feeling of societal consensus is something that the court is recognizing. But if we lose in front of the Supreme Court, then that will make vulnerable the marriages that have taken place as a result of federal court rulings in some but not all states. And certainly in Iowa and in other places where the state high courts ruled, same-sex couples will continue to be able to marry, and those marriages will not be vulnerable. But there are some states where I think we will have to fight very hard to continue to have same-sex couples able to marry, and of course we will have to fight in the courts of public opinion in order to eliminate marriage bans from state constitutions and to get legislation passed that repeals them.
Camilla Taylor is with us, for strategist and attorney for Lambda Legal, Mark Solomon, National Campaign Director for Freedom to Marry. We've got a couple minutes before we go to break, but Matt is on the line from Anamosa. What's your story? What do you want to tell us about the changing attitudes here?
Well, I just wanted to say on that base, my father has been with his male partner for about 20 years now, since I was about 3 years old. It's been pretty much all I've ever known. Never seemed weird to me. I was always, you know, around his other homosexual friends. And so it just never seemed like a conflict for me, whether it was right or wrong. It just was normal to me. But as far as on a national level, why it's changing, I think it has to do with, one, like other people have said, that people are starting to come out of the closet more, and people are starting to know homosexual friends, homosexual family members. So they're starting to see a more humane side of the homosexual front. But also ultra radicals, like when Matthew Shepard died, people are realizing how wrong that is, and it's having the complete opposite effect of what the people who perpetrate those acts are looking for. Instead of people siding with them, they're leaving and going towards pro-homosexual rhetoric.
Okay. Matt from Anamosa, thank you very much for your perspective. We're going to go to break now and come back with more discussion of advocacy for same-sex marriage. We're trying to take a longer view term here as we await the U.S. Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage, due out before the end of June. Joining us, Camilla Taylor of Lambda Legal, also Mark Solomon of Freedom to Marry. We'd like to have you join our conversation as well. Perhaps you didn't have the opinion you do now of same-sex marriage. Has your mind been changed in the last 10, 15, 20 years? What did it? We're talking about what made this actually tidal wave of public opinion change in the U.S. about same-sex marriage. 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a few minutes. Good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The justices of the High Court are deciding whether gays and lesbians have a constitutional right to marry, or whether state bans against same-sex marriage can stay in place. That decision to be announced before the end of June by the U.S. Supreme Court. That's why this hour we're hearing how advocates for same-sex marriage have been working for decades, actually, to have all marriages treated equally under the law in all 50 states, learning a little bit about their strategy, and reaching out to you to ask you what has been your opinion of this dramatic shift in our legal status of same-sex marriage in many of the U.S. states. Also, the court of public opinion, as it was expressed, this dramatic change. Now, over 60% of Americans saying that they are in favor of allowing same-sex couples to marry. 1-866-780-9100. Camilla Taylor, attorney and strategist for Lambda Legal, lead attorney and strategist in the Varnum case. That was the case which led to same-sex marriage being allowed here in Iowa in 2009. Mark Solomon, national campaign director for Freedom to Marry, author of Winning Marriage. Mark Solomon, perhaps you can update on the figures. I didn't have them right in front of me. Where do public attitudes in national surveys stand right now in terms of same-sex marriage?
No, you're right on target. We are now at supermajority support of the last three polls that I've seen are at 60% plus. And that includes majority support in every region of the country, including the South. So, you know, there really is a national consensus that, that same-sex couples should be able to marry and that the Supreme Court should resolve the issue once and for all.
Is there any sort of divide between young and old? How much does age play a role there in the opinion?
Age plays a significant role. We're getting to the point where 80%+ of younger people support marriage equality. But we also have majority support among among seniors, people over 65. And what we've seen is it's not simply a demographic thing. We've seen people's minds change in pretty much every segment of the population, seniors and younger voters and, Republicans as well as Democrats and, Latinos, African Americans, whites, so it's certainly the age, the difference in age plays a role, but we've seen people as more couples have gotten married, as more couples have talked about their relationships, we've seen people shift their positions across the board.
Camilla Taylor, before we go back to the phones, we do want to get listeners in on this, but briefly tell us, why is this different than a movement that's been compared often to, the civil rights movement of the 1960s, in which we saw public protest here? A lot of this happened in the courts.
Well, I think it's in many ways very similar, actually, to the civil rights movement. And of course, our cases in court stand on their shoulders. I mean, these giants who came before us, these amazingly brilliant lawyers like Thurgood Marshall, who created the precedent that allows courts today to think, oh, I know what box this fits in. It's a very familiar paradigm now when we seek to have access to the freedom to marry for an excluded group that hasn't been recognized as being allowed to marry in the past. That was similarly true for interracial couples because there have been racial restrictions on marriage since this country's founding, and yet the courts have already struck down those restrictions. And we were very fortunate, in fact, to have the support of the NAACP, Legal Defense and Education Fund, which was responsible for litigating the desegregation cases in the marriage cases that are currently before the Supreme Court. They came in on our behalf, and even before the Iowa Supreme Court, we had some wonderful briefs from law professors in Iowa who were extremely well known for their role in racial justice opinions and work, and from the Civil Rights Clinic of Howard University, their law school, submitted a wonderful brief in Iowa as well, charting those parallels. I think one of the reasons why we're seeing such rapid progress with respect to public opinion is because I think people are understanding that there are parallels, not just to the racial justice movement, but also to the movement to obtain equal rights for women. And so, just from a public consciousness perspective, we're aware of having learned as a nation that we were doing something that wasn't fair, and that we needed to become better, and that there was a promise of liberty and equality in our Constitution that we needed to live up to. That said, I think we all know, too, from past racial justice and women's rights movements, that a Supreme Court decision is never going to end our fight. that doesn't just make it all better for everyone. It will be an important step. It will be something that we need to celebrate and something that we've worked very hard to see. But there will be an enormous amount of work left to do, not just for lesbian and gay people, but also for transgender people as well and for people with HIV. There's just great injustice that's remaining because there are still kids who are committing suicide after coming out as trans or lesbian or gay. There are still people who are facing discrimination in the workplace, as I mentioned, and there are still parents who are being deprived of the ability to care for their own children because of misconceptions and discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And those are things that will remain regardless of how the marriage decision comes down.
Camilla Taylor is with us from Lambda Legal. Mark Solomon of Freedom to Marry. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Many, many callers to get in on this conversation. But first, let's go to Jay Kaplan, who is staff attorney for the LGBT Project for the ACLU of Michigan. Hello, Jay. Are you there?
I'm here.
We were mentioning Michigan in the earlier conversation with Camilla and Mark there as not a point to a state where same-sex couples have suffered setbacks. Tell us what's happened.
Well, we've had an issue in our state for quite some time. Not only did we have a law that prohibited same-sex couples from marrying, but also that the state would not recognize marriages that were granted in other jurisdictions. And then in 2004, voters approved a constitutional amendment that made, put in the Constitution that same-sex couples could not get married and that the state could not, state and local governments could not recognize a similar union for any other purpose. And our state Supreme Court interpreted that provision as meaning anytime the local government would recognize a same-sex relationship for purposes of a program or a benefit, that would be unconstitutional. So domestic partner benefits programs that were offered by local governments and colleges and universities, that became prohibited. Mm-hmm. And if that wasn't enough, our state legislature also passed a law that said if you remove domestic partner benefit programs and you call it something else, like you allow an employee to select an other eligible adult, somebody who lives in their household, if it happens to be a same-sex partner, that would be illegal. And we, the ACLU, we challenged that in federal court, and that provision was struck down as unconstitutional.
Tell us briefly, Jay, why there has been resistance to giving more rights to same-sex couples in Michigan.
Well, I think it was a response, a backlash to gains that have been made in the area of marriage equality. At the time the legislation was passed in 1996, that was the same time that the federal government, the federal legislature had passed DOMA. And then the 2004 constitutional amendment that was part of during the presidential election, it seemed like just about any state that was in play for the presidential race, they had on the ballot a constitutional amendment. In Michigan, our legislature has become more conservative over the past decade, as has our state courts. And I think some of these policies that have been introduced are reflective of some of the political viewpoints of the leadership.
Mm-hmm. Implications quickly of the U.S. Supreme Court decision for you in Michigan?
Well, obviously it would be a wonderful thing to have the court hold that it's unconstitutional to deny same-sex couples the right to marry and for Michigan to refuse to recognize legal marriages from other jurisdictions. So we are cautiously optimistic, and this would be a wonderful, wonderful thing to celebrate.
Okay. Jay Kaplan, staff attorney for the LGBT Project for the ACLU of Michigan. Thanks for your perspective.
Thank you.
Let's go to, we have a significant number of callers. We'll try to get to as many of you as possible. Thank you for being patient. Joe, you are calling from where?
I'm calling from Donahue.
Welcome. Iowa. Welcome, Joe. What's your perspective?
Well, I'm answering the question, how did we, my wife and I, change our minds with respect to gay marriage?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is that in 1999, our son came out to us. He was 19 at the time, came out to us as gay. Now, that was quite a shock that we had to adjust to. But as we got to thinking about it and adjusting to it, it just made common sense to my wife and I that our son should have the same rights and privileges as our our daughter, his older sister, why should he be denied rights and privileges that she had simply because he's gay?
Let me ask.
It just didn't make sense.
Yeah, Joe, let me ask you. Can I ask you what age bracket you and your wife are in?
Yeah, my wife and I are 68.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. Why does it make so much sense to you now when earlier in your life you would have probably said it doesn't make sense?
Well, we didn't have to face it in our own family. Now we do.
Mm-hmm.
He's our son. What are we going to do? Tell our son that he's no good, that he's not going to be accepted simply because he's gay? It didn't make sense.
Okay. And what about the national movement? Has that been part of changing your minds?
I think that's part of it, as our relatives, my brothers and sisters and my wife's brothers and sisters, as they have seen our son and recognize that he's just a wonderful human being that's doing, you know, work like everyone else. He's 34 years old. He works in Des Moines. He's successful. Why is he different? Why should he be treated different than any of his other cousins? Mm. You know, and it kind of spreads because you know someone who's gay and realize that they're just regular human beings like the rest of us.
Joe, thank you for your perspective from Donahue, for chipping in. We're asking you, what changed your mind? Did it get changed in the last 10, 15, 20 years in regards to same-sex marriage? 1-866-780-9100. Mark Solomon, you've run into many opinions, I'm sure. Mind changes like we heard from Joe and Donahue.
Yeah, and that actually, his story really is the, you know, is the reason we are where we are today. It's you know, it's gay people and coming out and talking about who they are, and then it's parents wanting to, you know, once they get over the shock and get over some adjustment, it's recognizing that they want the best for their kids, whether they're gay or straight, and you know, and wanting them to be able to marry just like their straight kids can get married, and talking about it. And that's, you know, that is it in a nutshell, talking about it to other family members, to friends, and that story times, you know, times several hundred thousand is, you know, it really personifies why we are where we are. And I can tell you the parents are some of the most powerful messengers we have, because they can speak to first their own discomforts, which, you know, is real. But then how they've evolved, how they've taken a journey and seen that, of course, we want everything. You know, we want the best for our kid. We want our kid to be treated with total respect. And we want him to be able to fulfill his vision of happiness. So that caller right there in about a minute really captured why this country has evolved so significantly.
Okay, let's get some other callers before our hour ends. Joshua in Waterloo. Joshua, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi. What's on my mind is I still to this day don't understand why so many of these decisions that are hitting the courts are faith-based. If you look at the idea of marriage, no governing body should have the right to dictate what who's married to how many who's.
You said these decisions are faith-based, but I believe they are not faith-based.
You don't think so? I think a lot of these decisions are coming down due, and the pressure for, the blocking of gay marriage is due to, any type of Abrahamic religion, whether it be Christianity, Islam, Judaism. I think a lot of these faith-based interest groups are the ones that are putting money and creating the agenda to say that, no,
I see what you mean.
Cannot get married.
I see what you mean now, Joshua. Camilla Taylor, so we're talking, clear this up, because this has been an area of blurring, murky waters a little bit. Does this say anything about marriage in the church?
Well, I think what the caller's getting at is that the decisions that have been coming down have all been based on state and federal constitutional guarantees. And, of course, our state and federal constitutions have a protection in the Establishment Clause of the Federal Constitution, for example, that prevents the state from making any decisions based on religion or from determining who the recipient of any sort of public benefit is by reference to religion. So the government, whether it's state or federal government, can never make determinations for other people based on, you know, what religion they are. It can never dictate that a certain religion must marry people if that religion doesn't want to marry people of different faiths or whatever. So government can never dictate to religious faiths whom that faith must marry. That's always been the case in our nation. And in fact, we have a storied history of protecting the separation of church and state, because when the settlers first came over here from Europe, one of the things that they were trying to escape from was that the Church of England, for example, governed who could marry in England. And so marriage was set up as a civil institution here in the United States that is exclusively a matter of civil law. So government licenses marriages, for example. And religions can marry people, but they do so pursuant to a state license, and government can never dictate whom a religion marries.
Okay. Joshua, I hope that answers your question. We're going to go to Ed in Mount Pleasant. Ed, what's on your mind?
Well, I just, you know, we were proud that Iowa was the third state to do this, and yet we it's going to be a footnote that the judges were run off the Supreme Court, you know, soon afterwards. And we certainly can't be proud of that.
Right. Camilla Taylor voted off the bench. Three Iowa Supreme Court justices ousted from their positions. They failed a retention vote in that 2010 election immediately following the Varnum decision. Does that stand out as Iowa being unique there? Did that happen anywhere else in the country?
It didn't. And it was a very sad day. And I think we still had some work to do at that time in helping to teach and inform the public about the role of the courts in our civic democracy. And, of course, Justice Wiggins was retained in the following election cycle. So there was, I think, a period of time in which people got used to the idea that same-sex couples were marrying, and they got used to the idea that this was a matter of a state constitutional guarantee, and they became comfortable with it. And I also think it's worth pointing out, too, that the justices in 2010 were the targets of a lot of out-of-state money and a huge effort from very big interest groups outside of Iowa who wanted to make an example of these justices who had been so courageous in ruling in favor of the freedom to marry for same-sex couples. And while they may have been successful in that election in succeeding in having these justices not retained by a very small margin, as Mark can tell you, this was a very rare occurrence. And in almost every other election in which people who had stood up for the freedom to marry were at risk of losing their seats, the public retained these folks, and they voted in favor of the freedom to marry. So it was an unfortunate thing that happened in Iowa. I think a lot of us feel very sad that we didn't do a better job of educating the public about the role of the courts, but it was also a very rare occurrence.
Mark Solomon, any words to that?
Well, I guess what I'd say is simply that, you know, what that shows is that this is a social movement, and, you know, it's crucial that that as we advance in the judiciary and as we win court decisions, we also move public opinion along, and we engage electorally, and we defend our friends in the legislature and in the courts where judges are elected, and we we look to certainly not to take out judges, because that's I think a terrible practice, but in legislatures, you know, we play very actively electorally. So it's, you know, in a social movement of which, you know, judicial decisions are a key element, it's crucial that we, you know, have all of our pieces, you know, all the elements of a campaign running together, you know, advocacy, public education, electoral engagement, passing bills in legislatures, so that court decisions are, you know, when we win a court decision, we can ensure that it sticks, and we can ensure that there aren't repercussions for the people who take the courageous, who make the courageous judgments.
Mm-hmm. Mark and Camilla, we have just a minute or two left here. I wanted to look forward to this long-awaited decision coming from the U.S. Supreme Court in the coming days. Very briefly, and I know you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but remind us what you're looking forward to in the case in either case, any of the options that you mentioned before. What are you ready to do? Camilla.
Well, we're all very ready to celebrate. We hope very much that the Supreme Court rules in favor of same-sex couples and requires that all states allow same-sex couples to marry and that all states respect the valid out-of-state marriages of same-sex couples. And this would have meaning not just for the members of the couples themselves, but also for their children. It would mean that a generation of children would grow up in this country understanding that their parents and their families are worth just as much as any other families, regardless of whether their parents are of the same sex, regardless of whether they're lesbian or gay or not.
Okay, Mark Solomon, what if you lose on both questions before the court?
Well, if we lose on both questions, we will keep at it, and it's part of social change in this country, and it's part of what our movement for equality has been all about. Is we've had setbacks, but we've always regrouped and we've always continued the fight. Because ultimately, our struggle for equality for LGBT people is part of the great American struggle for equality for all. The notion that all people are created equal. And, I have every confidence we are going to win this go around. Even if we were not, I have huge amounts of confidence that we're going to end up in the right place.
We have to go. Thank you, Mark Solomon, National Campaign Director for Freedom to Marry, and Camilla Taylor, Attorney and Strategist for Lambda Legal. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you
for having us.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.